I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. On November 14th, 2008, in Mountain View, California, the Lifeboat Foundation, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology co-sponsored a seminar titled Global Catastrophic Risks, Building a Resilient Civilization. Today we'll be listening to the keynote address by Dr. Anders Sundberg, laying out the general question of what are global catastrophic risks and how should we think about them.
I'm having a lot of complex affiliations. Usually when people come to us at the Institute and try to figure out where in the organization we fit in, we have to fill an entire whiteboard with weird Venn diagrams to show the set overlap. It's pretty messy. Which is, of course, a good thing, because the philosophy department allows us to study anything we're interested in. Which means that there are four main areas: human enhancement, global catastrophic risk, wisdom and rationality, and emerging technology. That covers almost anything, which is very good. So now I'm going to do a kind of impression here of Nick Bostrom, my director and friend. Unfortunately, well, he couldn't come. He sends his greetings. So you have to make do with another Swede from Oxford. We're hopefully sufficient alike, except that he got much less of an accent than I got. So, without further ado, let's get on with the interesting and disastrous stuff. So, global catastrophic risks are really the big threats against human well-being. And one way of trying to sort things is by the intensity of something going wrong and how large the scope is. So we can start out with the main amount possible loss, like the loss of one hair, which, unless you happen to have just one hair, that is probably both imperceptible and nothing really you care about. And then, of course, we have all the threats against our personal lives, which are pretty important the more intense we become. It's just that we also have a very big effect. Again, even an imperceptible threat on a very large scale can actually be problematic. The loss of one beetle species, nobody might notice it, but it is a permanent loss. And given how interesting a lot of beetles are, we actually should feel sad about the losing beetles. It's just as we move up here towards the corner, we get the more nasty ones. So there are certain threats which we might be able to endure, but they're global and they're bad for us. Losing the ozone layer and losing a lot of beetles, that's pretty bad. And we also get this weird case of terminal threats, which we might actually have on a global level, but you don't pay much attention to. Aging, for example. And quite a lot of people get surprised when we see aging up there. I don't think in this community I need to point out why actually this should perhaps be regarded as a global catastrophic risk. It's just that it's a risk that's very certain right now. It's just something we might be able to deal with. And then up in the red corner, which doesn't look very red here, but doesn't matter, is of course the threat of human extinction. So in general, existential threats, that's something that threatens the well-being of humanity permanently or terminally. We could imagine, for example, the 1984 scenario of eternal dictatorship. That could be an existential threat of a humanity that forever bonded itself into a very bad state. But of course, the classic one is that we're all just going to get wiped out. But there are lower levels of threat which are still pretty bad, and I think we can do a lot about them. So I'm hoping today we're going to be able to find ways of reducing the orange corner here. So in general, I was trying to get a look at what really big disasters were there. So we selected a somewhat random level of 10 million. And put it up there. And one of the interesting things about compiling this kind of list is to see what's on it and what's not. For example, a lot of natural disasters are not on this list. The biggest flooding disasters have hurt hundreds of thousands, up to even a few million people. But they still can't really get up on the level as in pandemics and human cruelty. And also, you might notice an overabundance here of stuff happening in China and India. And this is, again, because it's using a scale that's affected by the number of people. And since there is a lot of people in China and India, the bad things happening there will kill a lot of people. And this, of course, also creates a bias towards relatively recent events because there is a lot of people around. But if we go back and think about the Mount Toba eruption about 75,000 years ago, which might have been very, very close to wiping out our species, at that point, it probably didn't kill off that many people. It probably the order of perhaps tens of thousands to 100,000 people were killed. It was just that it seems from the genetic evidence of a bottleneck that we were actually down to perhaps a population of 200 females, which was very, very close for our species. But still, it wouldn't have been able to get onto the list. Similarly, in certain events of utmost cruelty, like the Nazi genocide, they still had just to squeeze them in. They're slightly below here. We also get overlaps. For example, the World War II. Well, should we put the lump that together with the Nazi genocides? What about the stuff Stalin did? Should that be put under the World War II and so on? So there is a lot of overlap. And there is an entire community looking at these ones, and they're having rather fun quarreling about the proper way of measuring atrocities. From our perspective, we just want to get rid of atrocities, but it is an interesting problem to see that even defining it is very problematic. It's also interesting to see that we're having these biases and uncertainty even about very direct disasters. We don't really know how many people were killed. And that is going to show up in a lot of places. We have a lot of uncertainty in our data, and there are good reasons to actually mistrust actively what's going on in the data in some cases. So, what kind of global catastrophic risk have we come up with? Well, this, I just ran out of vertical space. We can add a lot more, but I've been trying to add what I think is the big ones up here. And give them some run. I don't think there is any kind of order. And some of these ones are pretty obvious. And then there are ones with, like supervolcanoes, which I think teach us an interesting lesson. The term supervolcano, I think, was invented in the 90s. Before the 90s, we didn't know supervolcanoes could exist. We didn't realize that flood basalt are really sources of mass extinction and very, very serious climate change. So we suddenly discovered a natural disaster that if the Wyoming supervolcano would erupt, we would be in very, very deep trouble. And that is troubling, that we're still discovering new kinds of disasters. And if you go back 100 years and think about the disaster people were considering, that list was much shorter, not just because they couldn't make nuclear weapons, but also because we didn't know enough about the world. So that should make us aware that the category unknowns, it contains probably quite a lot of things that can have pretty big probability mass and be very nasty. Similarly, we have also weird new things which might or might not happen, and that makes them even harder to study. We don't have a language for the future. If we don't have any experience with the technology, we're very bad at discussing, and even worse with predicting what it can and cannot do. And at best, we can make some reasonable things based on the known physics and known physical laws, but having a big trouble actually saying something sensible about it. Usually, after we develop the technology further, we are going to realize we were pretty silly in our concerns or missed out the really bad side effects. So that means that some of the new technologies are going to pose very deep challenges. We just know that we're going to get a lot of technologies, some of them are going to be very powerful, and they're very, very likely to have some very bad potential ones. It's just that since everybody's looking at the bad effect of superintelligence, that might mean that we're going to miss some other, something similar that seems much more innocuous. Nobody has really considered the threats from quantum computers, Einstein-Bose condensates, because they don't seem to be dangerous. Which is rather weird, actually. How do we select rationally what seems to be dangerous or not? So looking at history, we have been pretty bad at that. So again, this is something we should be concerned about. And we can also, of course, look at the origin. And the natural exogenous events have a very nice property. They're not that dependent on what we humans are doing. Which means that the probability stays roughly constant over time, with some exceptions. We can make it much worse, of course. Flooding becomes worse if you chop down the woods, we can make ourselves more vulnerable by creating technological infrastructures that are vulnerable. But a lot of the big threats are human-made. We also have systemic threats, where we set up institutions or even attempts at fixing threats that in themselves can cause problems. Problems of financial markets are probably intrinsic from doing finance. And similarly, we might have problems in managing risks that are intrinsic from what we do. Accidental threats, I think most events tend to be accidental, but deliberate threats are much nastier because we can be fine-tuned to get around the defenses. One interesting thing that came up in the discussions in Oxford last summer was there is a lot of common pathways. And quite a lot of disasters end in the same way. For example, really big ones, you might risk social collapse. That suggests that fixing social collapse, for example, might be a very valuable thing because it would work against a lot of different kinds of disasters. Similarly, so a lot of causes might cause disasters, very different kinds of disasters, depending on, for example, technology level, but there's still a common pathway. In high international tensions, for example, might lead both to war and misuse of nanotechnology and nuclear detonations, depending on what nations and the situation is. But it's very clear that we can deal with the common cause here. And then there is correlation. Some disasters tend to be followed by others. Quite a lot of the big wars, for example, have been led to pandemics because it creates a lot of stress, a lot of people are living in bad conditions, and after the war, a lot of soldiers go home with the new germs they acquired somewhere else. And then there is the predictability. And I think Rumsfeld's classic distinction of known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, that's a very good start, but there is also the nasty fourth category, and that's the unknown knowns, the stuff that you actually know but choose to ignore. And I think there is, unfortunately, a lot in that category, and they're very good at ignoring stuff in that category.
You're listening to Dr. Anders Sundberg of Oxford University giving the keynote address at Global Catastrophic Risks, Building a Resilient Civilization, which was hosted by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, the Lifeboat Foundation, and the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology on November 14, 2008 in Mountain View, California.
So the good news is that we seem to have reduced a lot of the small and medium risks recently. But we still have a lot of problems, so we shouldn't forget that we have some ongoing horrors in the world that also needs fixing. And some of these ones might very well be almost up in that quadrant anyway. But the biggest risk seems to be anthropogenic, which has a good side. We can actually do something because we're deeply involved in it. The downside is that's going to mean getting a lot of people to cooperate, which is usually quite hard. And the really big and weird one are decades away. So we have some time. Unfortunately, that means we don't know much about them too. And we know that in the past, when people have been trying to predict the really serious threats, people have been very, very bad. For example, discussions about the future of humanity from the turn of last century, people were very concerned about dysgenics. Well, the good people are not having enough children, the bad people are having too many children. So what is going to happen to the race? Fortunately, we know that that seems to be a very minor problem. From what we actually, even if you're a very pessimistic geneticist, you see that the negative selection pressure we have in modern West are so weak that, well, we have much bigger problems to be concerned about. Actually, a lot of the things people did to try to fix the dysgenics turned out to be very, very bad indeed. So we know we've been bad in the past at doing predictions. So I'm returning to this point again and again because this is one of the main things I've ever learned in Oxford. Very smart people make very stupid mistakes. And they do it with a surprising regularity. So the trick should be figuring out how to avoid doing them regularly. Then, of course, while I'm just throwing out the interesting challenge here, is, of course, doing risk assessment in the right way. Estimating mistakes, that's a wonderful philosophical problem, and this is a great thing to invite philosophers out for a pub and trying to figure out, is the worth of mankind being wiped out just the loss of 6.5 billion lives, or is it worth? How much are the future generations worth? And here you can get some people thinking we should have some kind of discounting, and then somebody else gets very upset, no, there should be no discounting whatsoever. All of the future is actually dependent on our actions now, which can be extremely cumbersome. Because if you believe that we might actually have a chance at a glorious post-human future spreading throughout the galaxy, colonizing hundreds of billions of worlds, or maybe existing as post-humans in even more dense forms, it means that the future could be so enormously vast that the total value of that future would totally overshadow anything we would do today. We should perhaps sacrifice everything from that point of view for making sure that that big post-human future happens. At that point, a lot of people become very skeptical because it's just a possibility. We don't even have much evidence for it. But even if we just agree that 6.5 billion human lives, that's worth quite a lot. Even that can actually lead to some pretty surprisingly big actions we might need to take. And then there is the whole mess of probability. Once upon a time, I felt that probability was pretty easy. It wasn't too hard course to do in my studies. But dealing with the actual probabilities in real life is a completely different manner. The most pessimistic guy at our institute, he's from insurance. He's been handling real probabilities for many years, and he argues that philosophy and mathematics get it all wrong. And he has a lot of horrible examples showing that, yes, indeed, one in a million chances happen far too often. One reason is, of course, that we're simply making the wrong kind of estimates. But it's also that one in a million chance costs so much that it actually doesn't matter that it occurs very rarely, because we still get completely swamped by those really rare events. And then, of course, thinking about probabilities, what's the probability of mankind being going to be wiped out in the next 100 years? From a kind of objective probability perspective, that's not even a real probability, because it's not a frequency. So here, the subjective probability of Bayesian people gets into fisticuffs with the objective probability peoples. And then, of course, we have the problem that the probabilities are going to change. Right now, the threat from non-assemblers, I'm rather happy to say, is probably absolutely zero, or at least indistinguishable from it. But that's probably going to change over the next century. So it's going to be much larger than certain other threats. And similarly, I think the problem of giant steam explosions for steam engines, that's going down quite a lot. It was never high, but it's been reduced. The problem is, as probabilities change in size, that also means that some of them can screen us. The risk of nuclear war, let's say, in this part of a century, might actually be relatively low. But if it happens, of course, it's going to preclude a lot of other technologically advanced risks at the end of the century. Which means that if we're trying to figure out the probability of mankind being wiped out by nanomachines, if you think that nuclear war is relatively likely, you must reduce that other risk. At this point, it becomes very tricky to fill out forms about the probability estimate. So after our conference, we spent several evenings just debating what the meaning of these probabilities people have been given was. I think the most sensible thing is saying, well, it's not real probability in any sense, it's concern. Because, of course, in reality, risk is not just a harm times a probability, but we also add in how much concern we have. A hellish threat might actually be worth taking more serious than one that, well, people die, but we're rather happy about it. Not very many threats in that category, but it might exist. Then, of course, we have the interesting problem of anthropic biases. Our existence is already biasing the probabilities. We haven't had a giant nuclear war over the last 50 years, because we wouldn't be here. Our continued existence actually affects probabilities. We cannot just think about probabilities without taking into account and correcting for our own existence. If we look in the fossil records, we will not find any giant meteors that wiped out all life on Earth, simply because no observers on such planets would exist. And this actually produces some very weird things. I'm working on a paper with Nick about this, where we actually find that you can correct for it, given some assumptions. But it's going to produce a bit of weird problems. And then there is, of course, that real low probability issues, like some of the threats, like, for example, a particle accelerator accidentally creating a black hole that wipes us all out. The probability of a paper demonstrating that the risk is zero is wrong, is so much higher than the risk, actually, an acceptable risk. If we're talking about the fire insurance, the probability of the estimation being wrong, it doesn't matter that much, because it's not likely to really lead to a bad event. But if somebody says that, oh, it's a one in a million chance, then whatever that was happens. It's much more likely that that occurred not because we were really, really unlucky and actually had a one in a million chance, but simply because the estimation was wrong. And this leads to interesting problems. The people at the Large Hadron Collider had a lot of people who were very concerned about them destroying the world. And like all good physicists, they just laughed it off because, of course, they knew intuitively that, oh, it's unlikely. It's very clear that it's not going to happen. That's never going to convince people. And there was, when the Brookhaven report came out about the risk of strangers, Glasshow in Nature wrote that, oh, we always knew the probabilities were really low, but it's nice that somebody bothered to calculate them. When you think about it, it's actually a very weird statement. More recently, Miguel Mangano wrote a marvelous paper demonstrating that there is absolutely no risk of black holes. But it's a 50-page complicated paper involving a lot of general relativity and other things. What's the likelihood of that paper being wrong? Well, looking at the scientific literature, we find that a lot of papers are wrong. A very conservative estimate would be at least one paper in 1,000. Which means that even if we accept that it's a very good paper, we still have a chance in 1,000 that is wrong, and that we might actually find that there exists some other problem. So the way around this might be to make several independent arguments. And to his credit, Magano actually did this. So his paper actually, when you pick it apart, you get three independent arguments. And the chance of each of them being wrong, that's just one chance in a billion, assuming they're independently correct. And one chance in a billion, that's pretty small. It's just that one chance in a billion multiplied by 6.5 billion people would still be 6.5 people risking getting killed. Still a little bit too much, I think, for a PR department at CERN. So what we ideally should have is get a few grad students to write two or three papers more, independently deriving a few others. And that way we can cover up the probability and get a very robust estimate. Of course, so that's going to take valuable time for doing real physics and more interesting things. And the crackpots who are really concerned are never going to read the papers anyway, and they're not going to get the probability argument. But there are ways of handling really low probability. As Eliezer pointed out in his chapter in the risk book, if we couldn't handle really low probability, all the lotteries in the world would go bust. So there is hope here. Then there is, of course, the problem of cognitive biases. We're not very good at thinking rationally at all. And some of these biases are very big, and some of them are very common, some of them are very confusing. We tend to, for example, if I show you a lot of examples of what might go wrong, you're very likely to increase the likelihood you assign to them happening. So that's actually one of the risks of meetings like this. You're probably going to go back home thinking that the risks are slightly higher than before. Rarely you might get a good argument that, oh, the risks were actually overblown. Similarly, we know that you have availability bias. If I can give you a few examples, and you're going to regard this risk as likely. And conversely, if something has never happened, people tend to assign a far too low probability to it. And we do consistent errors with probability estimates, etc., etc. Then there are the social biases. A lot of the things we're interested in here tend to be regarded by people as silly. And I've been thinking for a long time that I really ought to write a long paper just analyzing silliness. It has a lot of interesting categories. Some things are silly because they're useless. Some things are silly because they're unlikely. Some things are silly just for social reasons. Nobody seriously studies that area. The people who are in that particular area are regarded as crackpots for social reasons, which can, of course, bias a lot of research and concern in a lot of very, very bad ways. And on the other hand, we have millennialism. James gave a very nice talk about millennialist thought. And given that people don't, on one hand, they don't want to appear as naive millennialists, so they would underplay a lot of this risk. On the other hand, it's very fun being a millennialist. A lot of people get a lot out of that, so they might be overly concerned about some risks, especially maybe the wrong risks. And we have passed the evidence of incompetence. And then, of course, the whole issue of what would be the rational way of spreading our effort, which again becomes very interesting because we have a radical uncertainty here. So we might go for the biggest threats. But on the other hand, we had the screening effect. So earlier threats might be more important. There was a sketching editorial in Nature of the book where the reviewer took Nick to task for not dealing enough with climate change. Well, it was discussed in the book, but it was one chapter among other. But the reviewer felt that since climate change is such an urgent thing, we really should focus on that. But given the financial crisis, maybe since we need money to fight the climate change, we should just, in that case, focus on the financial crisis. That kind of thinking doesn't really work. Obviously, we need to distribute our effort in a rational way. But given that we have a hard time even agreeing on probabilities, it's going to be interesting and problematic. So we need to figure out ways of dividing the labor here. Similarly, we have also a lot of threats we don't know very much about, where a little research effort can actually get a lot of information. For example, the threat from asteroids seems to have receded quite a lot thanks to the Space Watch study, because they actually found that, yes, there are rather few asteroids that pose a threat. So a lot of uncertainty disappeared, and a lot of potential threat just evaporated, which is very good, because now we can focus on other things. We still should, of course, watch the skies, but we now know that we don't need to watch for certain things. And then there is, of course, some threats are more political than others. And this, of course, gets very much into the debate of climate change, nuclear disarmament. Meanwhile, nanotechnology is not a political question yet for many years, so it might be very hard to deal with that threat. So again, we might think about dealing with where to put our efforts. So we should think about the best levers and try to find a way of wiping out emerging threats before they hit us. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Anders Sandberg of Oxford University talking about global catastrophic risks. He gave the keynote at the seminar on global catastrophic risks and building a resilient civilization, hosted by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology, and the Lifeboat Foundation in Mountain View, California, on November 14, 2008. Check the IET website for additional audio, video, and texts of that seminar. And many thanks to Jerry Aska for the audio and video taping and transcribing of the seminar presentations. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Our opening and closing music was composed and recorded by Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.